Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by Celebrate Our God-Given Freedom and Faith While Honoring Our Blessed Mother with Ghirelli's USA Rosary. Each state is represented on this rosary's 50 beads. Red, white, and blue enamel adorn its patriotic crucifix. Get yours today. Shop www.ghirelli.com. Introducing the redesigned CatholicSingles.com, featuring new ways that put the spotlight on the person and their faith, not just a profile picture. For the past 20 years, faithful Catholics have used CatholicSingles.com, and the reimagined CatholicSingles.com website is ready to help single Catholics take the next step in sharing meaningful relationships with other faithful Catholics. Remember, CatholicSingles.com for faith, fellowship, and love.
What do we know about the Egyptians of Moses' time? Right now on Catholic Answers Focus. Hello and welcome again to Catholic Answers Focus. I am Cy Kellett, your host, joined today by our senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, Jimmy Akin. Hi, Jimmy.
How do you, Cy?
There were these people in the ancient world called the Egyptians.
Oh, yeah. They had a special walk. You had to learn how to walk like an Egyptian.
Oh, I had forgotten that. Yeah. That must have been very uncomfortable to constantly have to walk like that.
Oh, you had to wear bangles, too, when you did it.
If you don't know what he's referring to, you just have to look that up on the internet. Okay, so at one point, this well-known historical ancient people, the Egyptians, also served as the captors for the people we now know as the Jews.
Yes.
So there's this interaction. And so I want to ask you about that in these two episodes.
Right. So we're going to be talking about Moses is where we're heading, but we're going to set the stage by talking about Egypt.
Right. So the society that Moses would have grown up in there in Egypt was already a well-developed society by
the
time. Like, whoa, eyes got big. Like, how well that well-developed was it?
Well, so we're living 2,000 years after the time of Christ, and Egyptian civilization goes back like at least 5,000 years before Christ. So it's like 7,000. We recently found a cemetery in Egypt that has, you know, some of the bodies are like 7,000 years old.
Really?
And originally, Egypt was not the arid desert it is today. It was much more moist than it is now. But over the course of time, it dried out so that the principal source, except for a few oases, the principal source of water is just the Nile River.
Okay.
And so you had the Nile River running down Egypt, or running up Egypt, I should say, because the Nile starts in the south and flows north to the Mediterranean Sea.
Right.
And that's why Southern Egypt is called Upper Egypt.
Oh, because it's because up via the river.
Up the river.
Yeah.
And Northern Egypt is called Lower Egypt because it's down the river. And that really shaped Egyptian culture. And because, so every year, the Nile, they basically have three seasons. So I guess we're kind of talking about the geography of Egypt right now.
Yeah.
They have three seasons in Egypt. They have the year begins when the star Sirius rises, and that signals that the Nile is about to flood. And that is a that because the where down at the origin of the Nile, they have mountainous snows that melt every year. And so like every July or so,
those famous African snows that we all know so much
like
about.
On the snows of Kilimanjaro.
Oh, yeah, right. Okay.
And so every July or so, you know, Sirius rises and the Nile begins to flood, and that initiates the season called inundation.
Okay.
And so the Nile floods and it brings all this topsoil down through the Nile Valley, and that fertilizes the ground, so it makes it very fertile for farming. And then they have a season, each of these seasons is about 4 months. Then they have a season called emergence, where the flood waters recede and the land emerges again, and you can plant it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Egyptians would start growing crops, specifically like wheat and so forth. And then you have summer, which is where it's just all dry and you're waiting for the next inundation. And because the Nile Valley was so fertile, the Egyptians could grow more than just subsistence level crops. They could grow more food than they needed to feed everybody.
Yeah.
And that meant not everybody had to be a farmer. You could have more complex, sophisticated ways of governing your society with people who could specialize in things besides farming.
Mm-hmm.
So you could have a standing army.
Oh, yeah. You're rich, basically.
Yeah. You could have an established priesthood of people who just tended to religious things.
Uh-huh.
You could have an established government. And so that led to the formation of the system of pharaohs, starting with the first dynasty. The first notable pharaoh was a guy named Narmer, and he was, if I recall correctly, about 3000 BC. So
wow.
5,000 years ago.
Yeah.
And approximately. Yeah. And so by the time of Moses, there had already been Egyptian civilization for like 1,500 to 1,700 years.
And okay, so let's just real quick then give a date for Moses, approximate date for
Moses. Well, you could say... there are sort of two theories that are commonly advocated. The traditional one is that Moses lived in the 1400s BC and that the Exodus occurred around the year 1446 BC. The more recently popular theory is that Moses lived in the 1200s BC and that the Exodus occurred no later than 1250 BC.
All right. So, For these Jews then living there, they wouldn't have been called Jews at the time, right? They would have had
They were called Hebrews or Israelites because they were descended from Israel. Jew is a later term. It means an inhabitant of Judah.
Yeah. Okay.
Because of the kingdom of Judah, one of the 12 tribes became prominent.
So they're living there in Egypt, and Egypt is I guess the heart of the world at the time. Like there would have been people all around.
Yeah. It's one of the cradles of civilization.
Okay.
It's not the only civilization at the time. In fact, Egypt was, you notice I mentioned they have a standing army.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, well,
why do you need that?
Why do you need that? Because there are other people out there. And they didn't just use their army defensively. They used it. They had a kind of view of the economy that was it's a zero-sum game. Wealth does not get created. It only gets taken.
Yeah, right.
And so one of the jobs of the pharaoh was to go take wealth from other people.
Mm-hmm.
And so every year or so, pharaoh would lead the army out. They'd beat up on some foreign nation, take everything that wasn't nailed down, bring it back to Egypt, and require what was called tribute of the people they had conquered. And anytime the people, so like every year you're supposed to send some of your stuff to Egypt to keep them from invading you. It's like a protection racket. And if you don't, then they're likely to come back and reinvade you.
So for a tribe like the Israelites.
Oh, and by the way, there's a famous picture. You see it in Egyptian art. Egypt was amazingly conservative. Socially. So like once they set up their artistic system and their governmental institutions, they kept them for 3000 years. and so right back on the Narmer palette, we have Narmer depicted in what's called the smiting position.
Oh, he's smiting.
Where he's got a foreigner by his hair.
Yeah.
And he's got one of his other arm raised up with a club. He's ready to smite this foreigner.
Yeah.
To show the dominance of Egypt. And this smiting position you see in Egyptian art from Narmer forward.
So the pyramids.
They're kind of like the Goa'uld.
that's from Atlantis.
Stargate SG-1.
Sorry. Yeah. Okay. So what we think of as ancient Egypt, probably the primary image that you might get is the pyramids at Giza.
Yep.
So would the Israelites have been part of building those?
No.
Okay.
No, absolutely not.
Why not?
So the pyramids are interesting, and the way they got started originally, Egyptians buried their dead in pits. They didn't have any special, they didn't have any special way of protecting the bodies or anything. They would bury them in pits and they would naturally mummify because of the arid, arid climate. Later they found out ways to mummify them even better. Mm-hmm. And it became a special profession. It actually took 70 days to mummify somebody. And they later did it for Joseph.
They did?
Yeah.
I didn't know.
Oh, yeah. And Jacob. And so, like, some of the biblical patriarchs were mummified in Egypt. In any event, they initially buried people in pits, but if you don't protect the bodies, animals are going to come and predate them.
Right.
So they said, okay, let's try to protect the bodies. Let's put a big stone thing over them. And it looks like a bench. It looks like a big kind of or a shoebox. You know, it's a big stone thing, kind of like a shoebox or a bench. And the Arabic word for bench is mastaba. And so they would put mastabas over the dead as their tomb, as kind of like their coffin.
Right.
And even today we have, when you bury someone in a coffin, they usually put a mastaba-like thing over it before they fill in the dirt.
Right.
In any event, you know, people naturally say, okay, how can we make this fancier with the course of time? And somebody got the idea, well, okay, I don't want just a mastaba for my tomb. I want a smaller mastaba on top of the big mastaba.
And two mastabas better than one.
Yeah, it's going to be fancier than everyone else's tomb. And that got a competition going where the stylish thing to do was to start stacking mastabas on top of each other.
I like see what shape we're heading
like
towards.
Like the layers of a wedding cake.
Right.
And that eventually gave us pyramids.
Okay.
And pharaohs, of course, being at the top of the food chain in Egypt, they need the biggest burial structures of all. So they need their stack of mastabas to be really huge and impressive. And they didn't always, at first, they were experimenting, how do you do this? And they didn't always get it right. So there's one pyramid where they started building and they wanted to put casing stones on it to make it smoother. So it's not just a step pyramid like a wedding cake. They wanted it to be smoother. And they didn't, they built it at too steep an angle and it all slid off.
Yeah, not good.
And there's another one called the Bent Pyramid, where they started building at one angle, but as they got it high up, they realized it's too steep, and they had to change it to a shallower angle.
That's the way I build things.
Yeah. So that's why it's called the Bent Pyramid. There's another one they had to just abandon because it's structurally unsafe on the inside. If you go in it today, you're not allowed to unless you have special permission because it's so dangerous. But you, like, go into the burial chamber, and they've got big cedar logs from Lebanon holding the stones apart to keep it from collapsing.
No way I would go in there. I don't want permission. Okay.
But then by the time of a guy named Khufu, or Cheops to use his Greek name, they got it right. And so they started building on the Giza Plateau, which is right outside of Cairo. Cairo is actually grown around it.
Yeah.
So it's kind of fun. If you're driving down the freeway in Cairo, you're looking at all these more modern buildings and then peeking up in the background. Oh, they're the pyramids.
That's some good construction.
Yeah. So you had the pharaoh Khufu build the Great Pyramid, and then his successor built one that's actually a little higher up, but it's not quite as tall. And then like one of the grandsons also built another slightly smaller one there. And then there's some ones that were built for queens. But those were all built in what's called the Old Kingdom, like around the 5th dynasty, if I remember correctly.
So that would be...
So this is like more than 2000 BC.
Oh, so they've been there for hundreds of years by the time Moses is there.
Yes, yes. They're sort of...
I think some movies might have gotten this wrong.
Yeah, they did, yeah.
Okay.
There are several different major periods in Egyptian history. The first is called the Old Kingdom because it's the earliest. Then they their civilization kind of fell apart. And they had what's called the first intermediate period. Then they got it all back together. They restored all those old institutions that had worked for them. And they had the Middle Kingdom.
Okay.
And then it fell apart again. You had the second intermediate period. Then you have the New Kingdom.
Okay.
Well, we're living in, by Moses's time, in either the 18th or the 19th dynasty. So the pyramids have been there for hundreds of years.
Uh-huh.
So they did not build the pyramids. They would have seen the pyramids.
Okay, so and Moses they would have himself looked, would have seen the pyramids.
Yeah, and they would have looked more impressive than they do today, because back then they had white limestone casing stones on them. Uh-huh. So they would have been smooth and white.
Wow.
And unfortunately, those stones later got taken off. And if you want to see them today, they were what was used to build the mosques of Cairo.
You're kidding me.
Nope.
Really?
That's where they are now.
Oh. Okay. So talk about cultural appropriation.
Yeah.
Come on.
Really?
All right. So what then, we'll just to wrap up this section, and then the next episode
talk more about Moses. Okay.
What's the society like then? You've got these great buildings. Is it an urban society? What would it have been like that Moses lived in?
It's somewhat urban, because everybody pretty much had, unless you were living in an oasis somewhere, you pretty much had to live in the Nile River Valley.
Okay.
And so that led to big cities. Not everyone was in the city. I mean, there were farmers all over the place up and down the Nile Valley, but there were big cities too. And they built these huge monuments. That was one of the things that pharaohs did, was they would conduct building projects and like temples for the gods and stuff. There's a famous one known as the Temple of Karnak, which has this hypostyle hall. That means it's massive, huge pillars, or hypostyles. Just huge. And then they would carve the deeds of the pharaoh on these monuments, which is how we know so much about
That's
Egyptian
good
history.
For historians.
Yeah, it is.
Thanks.
Once we cracked the language, we could like totally read this stuff. All this history became available to us.
So was Karnak the Great buried there?
No.
No? Okay. So that leaves me, because I got a couple minutes.
Yeah.
When did people begin to be able to read Egyptian, the hieroglyphs?
It was not known. The knowledge of it was lost until the 1800s. And in the early 1800s, Napoleon Bonaparte conducted a military and scientific expedition to Egypt. He went there to conquer Egypt, but also to study it.
Mm-hmm.
And so while they were there, his guys found what's known as the Rosetta Stone. And the Rosetta Stone is... it was commemorating some events, and it mentions Queen Cleopatra in it. So it's very late. She was actually not Egyptian by birth. She was Greek.
Yeah.
So she was one of the Greek pharaohs. But it has writing on it in two different styles of Egyptian writing and in Greek. And so after that, scholars were able to look at the Greek, which they understood, and compare it to the Egyptian and figure out the Egyptian language. And that was done primarily by a guy named François Champollion in the mid-1800s in France. And that was what unlocked our knowledge of ancient Egyptian history.
And all that, those thousands of years of history became light.
Readable to us.
Yeah. So you can go read the graffiti. You can go read the inscriptions.
I've read a little bit of, I've trained myself to read a little bit of hieroglyphics. I can look at stuff. One of my favorite characters, my favorite hieroglyphs is the evil bird. It's a little small bird they put at the end of things to indicate that this is evil or bad or worthless.
We need that.
Yeah.
We need an angry bird for Jimmy Akin is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers as our guest for Focus this time and next, where we will continue our conversation by looking at the historical, or I should put a question mark, historical person named that we now know as Moses. We'll do that next time on Catholic Answers Focus. Thanks so much for being with us. If you like Focus, would you maybe make a comment wherever you get this podcast, whether it's at iTunes or wherever else you get it, or leave us a thumbs up or some kind of a positive comment and share it with other people. We'd really like Focus to grow and be shared with more people. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. We'll see you next time on Catholic Answers Focus.
I'm Father Dwight Longenecker. I'd like to invite you to join me for a pilgrimage tour to France this September. It's based on my book, St. Benedict and St. Therese, The Little Rule and the Little Way. I'll be teaching about the spiritualities and the lives of these two great saints, and we'll be visiting the great monastery of Fleury, where St. Benedict's relics are venerated, and of course going to Lisieux to visit the childhood home of St. Thérèse, the Carmel where she was a nun, and the great basilica dedicated to her honor. But there's more than that. At Paris, we'll be visiting the Basilica of Sacré-Cœur, Rue de Bach with the Miraculous Medal, going on to Vézelay, Nevers with St. Bernadette, Paray-le-Monial, where the devotion to the Sacred Heart of Jesus was given to St. Margaret Mary, and then Chartres Cathedral, Mont-Saint-Michel, the Normandy beaches, and more. I think there's not only going to be time for instruction and learning, but also prayer and worship, celebrating Mass in the various locations, and also time for fellowship and a good bit of French food and wine, too. Come and join us this September. If you'd like to know more, go to CatholicHeritageTours.com. That's CatholicHeritageTours.com, or be in touch with me through my website, DwightLongenecker.com.
Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at CaneFord.com.